All right, welcome back to the Rodcast. It is a smooth so Monday. My man Patrick, the co-host and the idillionaire on the show, always comes up with the musically themed days of the week. And the purpose of a smooth so Monday is to make the transition from your stress-free, fun-filled, happy, good time so the weekend, especially your holiday weekend, to make that transition just a little bit smoother to the hectic, stress-filled work week filled with meetings and traffic and all types of responsibility and adulting. Nobody wants to have any of that. So my man Patrick makes that a smooth transition for you with a smooth soul Monday. So we appreciate that. Also, we appreciate the topic for the Big Fat Poll of the Day. And the people, man, they have spoken. The big topic for the Big Fat Poll of the Day: which big free agent signing will make it further in the playoffs next year? And right now, out of the four choices, Chris Paul, Klay Thompson, Paul George, DeMar DeRozan, Klay Thompson leading the charge there. 61% of you, a lot of Mavs fans, believe that Klay Thompson will help make the Mavs. Basically, I mean, to take them further than the playoffs next year. I mean, to go further
I mean,
than
I
the
think
finals,
further, but it won't be further than the finals. It'll be further than any of these other guys.
Getting back there.
Yeah, it'll be getting further than any of the other guys. So Chris Paul, it'll get further than the Spurs. Or
I got you.
Yeah, so it'll be that. But yeah, no love for DeMar. No love for the Kings whatsoever.
Yeah, I can understand that. I mean, Chris Paul, that's the Spurs. Klay Thompson, that's the Mavs. At least with Paul George, you know, he's more of a known commodity. Going with the 76ers, too.
Yeah.
And 76ers got an MVP on that team.
It's Eastern Conference.
What do the Kings have, and what is DeMar DeRozan going to bring to the Kings? Like, what he's going to bring to the Kings?
More,
I mean,
more
he's going to be a good player.
More scoring.
Them, but is he actually going to put them over the top?
But I think they have a chance to get, what, second round, third round. You know, there's a chance they get the Western Conference Finals. There's a chance they can. I would say, I'd say there's more of a chance than Chris Paul. There's more of a chance than Spurs. Because they just have a better team around him right now.
Yo, of course. I agree with that. Yes, I agree with that. They'll go, I think, yes, the Kings should be better than the Spurs. And, well, the Mavs, like I said, other if you look at what they're bringing back and what they've accomplished last year, I can see why the Mavs, I mean, even though it's a lot of Mavs fans voting in the poll, I can see why the Mavs would be the pick. I mean, the Mavs would have been my choice, too. I just, man, Paul George and the you know, the 76ers, I worry about Embiid and his health late in the season. Not that you have to worry about that with everybody in the NBA. And then with the Mavs, the West, as we talked about, it is a treacherous journey through the Western Conference. The regular season will be tough enough, but then the playoffs, play in being a part of that, man, it's a battle of, you know, just kind of I do ultimately think in the West, your path, as you pointed out, matters a lot. But there are so many teams in the middle class or lower in the Western Conference that are actually good teams or could even be really good teams if they stay healthy and everything falls right for them. So it's just tough. I like the Mavs, and I did predict the Mavs would have an MVP, and they would. I thought they would. That Kyrie Irving trade would be really good for them. I thought it'd work out. I didn't think they'd make it to the finals. So they overachieved last year. Don't know if that's an outlier or if that is the coming of age of Luka being considered one of the top three best players in the game. He's going to be there for a while. So lots to consider. But good stuff there with Patrick and the Big Fat Poll. They go check it out at the Horn ATX on the X platform there. We'll get to some NFL news, notes, and nuggets. But first, let's get informed, educated, and updated on all the top stories today with Patrick Davis and the Horn headlines.
All right, your Horn headlines brought to you by Top Gun Rentals and Lawn Equipment. In the NBA, the Sacramento Kings, Kings acquired free agent DeMar DeRozan in a three-year, $74 million sign-and-trade deal. The Kings are trading Harrison Barnes and an unprotected 2031 pick swap to the Spurs and Chris Duarte and a 2 second-round picks to the Bulls to complete the deal. DeRozan, a 6-time All-Star who will turn 35 next month, is coming off an impressive 3-year scoring run with the Bulls, where he averaged 24 points per game last season. In the MLB, the Astros dropped their series to the Twins 2-1 after a Christian Vasquez walk-off home run on Sunday. The Astros are now 2 games back of Seattle for the lead in the AL West, with 2 more series to go before the All-Star break. Ronyel Blanco will get the start for Houston when they return to action against the Marlins on Tuesday. And the Rangers set the Tampa Bay Rays over the weekend, including a dominant 13-2 win on Sunday. Corey Seager and Travis Jankowski both added 4 RBIs each, while Nathan Eovaldi pitched another solid start, going 7 innings, only allowing 2 runs. The Rangers begin a series with the Angels tonight, hoping to continue their winning momentum, with John Gray taking the mound. And that is your Horn headlines.
All right, thank you, Patrick, for the Horn headlines. We'll get a Rangers report for you, too. I neglected to tease the Rangers report we got coming up for you, so we'll get to that as well as the rant of the day coming up later on in this hour. In the rant of the day, I got 2 different topics we'll get into. We'll talk about scoring first in football, why it matters so much, give the stats on that, and also the biggest or the best states for producing NFL talent and regions, really. I actually noticed this trend when I was looking at this new study done about states that produce the most NFL players per million citizens, per million people in that state. So we'll get to that too coming up here a little bit later on. But first I want to get to the Cowboys drama. There always is some Cowboys drama. So Dak Prescott over the holiday weekend was spotted in a boot. And a lot of Cowboys fans freaked out when they saw him in the boot, thought, oh, man, he's hiding an injury. Dak Prescott got hurt when that happened. How did he get hurt? Because it wasn't during the OTAs or mini camps, so he must have done something on his own. That was cleared up, I would say, within hours because it became such a big story and went viral, the photo of him in Cabo San Lucas with a boot on. Todd Archer of ESPN points out that Dak Prescott recently suffered a minor right foot sprain that temporarily required a walking boot. They do not know when this foot sprain happened. The Cowboys last held an organized workout on June 5th. They don't think he suffered the injury there, but he could have suffered the injury there. At least he did not have the walking boot at the time. The injury is not expected to impact Dak Prescott when the Cowboys hold their first training camp practice on July 25th. It was unclear at the time. The picture was taken in Cabo San Lucas when Dak was on vacation. And they say he is no longer wearing the boot. The picture was taken last Wednesday. And as of when this report came out, which was this past weekend on Sunday, he is no longer wearing the boot. So within a couple of days. So it seems like it was all precautionary, and it seems like it was just him being safe, just trying to be overly cautious with the injury that he had. And it was a small, minor right foot sprain is being described here. So, nothing to see here. No big deal. Looks like Dak is going to be healthy. He was just making sure. Worst case scenario, if something did happen, he was safeguarding himself against any injury while on vacation. So good for Dak.
Yeah.
But that story did blow up. People got a little bit crazy.
Yeah, I saw it pop up when I wasn't paying the most attention over the weekend at some things, and I still saw that story come up and had to look into it to go, what happened? And then you just realize it was really nothing. But yeah, it's, you know, ankle injuries happen a ton. Yeah. You know, he could have just been doing a workout and slipped a little bit off stepped on a stone or something, you know, whatever you're doing or going on a run and you just take a wrong step. And it feels like if you ever were in school and someone got hurt and then all of a sudden they had crutches the next day and you're like, there's no way you're hurt that bad. It felt like it's more very much precautionary. this is a big, big season for me. It's a big time right now. We're talking, life-changing money that is about to be done, whether it's at camp or whether it is at after the season. He is going to get life-changing money, most likely. So you want to play it on the safe. I'm sure he owned a boot at the house, so he just said, let's throw this boot on. just to be safe. So I feel good about it, getting, you know, walking around, and if I'm going to be walking in some sand and maybe hurt myself or get on a boat and I don't want to slip where it's wet, and all of a sudden, you know, now I'm out for training camp and Jerry's calling my agent saying, you want us to invest in this guy? Can't even stay healthy in the off season. And, yeah, you know, I get why he put the boot on, but it is funny. I'm sure that's not the way you want to spend your vacations, waking up and like, nope, somebody saw it. Of course they did. And now I have to explain it. And I think it's for the best, you know, and as long as he addressed it, which he did, it's no big story. It would have been worse if he did not address it and just let it hang out there. But he knew what it was. He's dealt with this stuff.
No choice.
He's been a Cowboys quarterback long enough to know that that would be a story.
Exactly. It's like, dude, it's the slow season, and you were spotted with a boot on in a year where everybody expecting you to set the market for the highest paid quarterback in NFL history, highest paid player in NFL history. Oh, yeah, because that's a serious injury. Then it actually does affect the contract negotiations. It's not, so it won't. No big deal there. But that was the big story that kind of blew up for the Cowboys. Also, this is a minor story, but I think it highlights a unique issue for the Cowboys. And I don't know if it's necessarily unique as much as it is all too common with the Cowboys. But the Cowboys always have like a lot of beef and pettiness within the organization, whether it be with current players, between current players, former players, between current and former players, between players and their family members, and players' family members criticizing the team. Like, it's just they got a lot of that happening all the time. We see, like, every week we talk about one of these different stories. And last week it was Micah Parsons and, Micah Parsons and Malik Hooker. Remember that one? Malik Hooker said something on a podcast about Micah Parsons, and Micah Parsons didn't like it. Micah Parsons had a response, had to delete the response on Twitter, and then the family drama always plays out publicly for the Cowboys. Hell, we had the Micah Parsons and DeMarcus Lawrence thing after the season. They lost to the Packers, and they were in some kind of beef. You know, it's always, hell, remember the Jesse Holly, Micah Parsons? I know it seems like there's a common theme, but it's not just Micah. It's CeeDee Lamb's mama criticizing Dak, saying Dak ain't it. You know, it's all these – Dak's brother always got something to say about the team and how they don't build enough around Dak and don't respect Dak enough. That's always coming up. Des Bryant's always got – so there's just always this beef and kind of pettiness within the Cowboys organization. And I think they kind of promote it. They embrace it, actually, because they're the number one TV star on America's number one TV show, which is the NFL. And they are kind of a reality TV show. And, you know – that's why Micah having his own podcast and how that's come up. And matter of fact, that was one of the things Malik Hooker brought up, was Micah and his podcast. They're just kind of the Kardashians of the NFL. So their family drama plays out publicly, and they don't mind it because it keeps them in headlines. As we know, pettiness pays off. It actually does. Pettiness pays, as what it's done for women's basketball, you know, them being petty and having beef. Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark really has brought a whole new level of interest to the game. Yeah, we just saw it in hip-hop, right? Kendrick Lamar and Drake and a beef has kind of revitalized hip-hop to an extent. We like beef. We like petty. It sells. And I think the Cowboys, whether knowingly or unknowingly, have embraced that mantra. And I think for Jerry, it's definitely knowingly. But the latest one is CeeDee Lamb and Cole Beasley. Don't ask me why they got beef, but they just did on social media, and it played out. So CeeDee Lamb always releases these really – cool workout videos because he's just a freak of nature, and you can see how really just how his footwork is elite. I've never seen anything like the footwork of CeeDee Lamb. He might have the quickest feet of any wide receiver in the league right now. I mean, you're talking about feet on fire kind of thing. And he tweeted out one of his workout videos just showing some of the things that he does. And then Cole Beasley tweeted out, man, just do some heavy squats and power cleans. ... Thought he might have been joking when he said it. Maybe he was joking, maybe he wasn't. Then the Cowboys Twitter, they get after Cole Beasley. What are you talking about? Are you trying to tell CeeDee Lamb how to work out? Blah, blah, blah. And then he tweets out in response to the criticism, give me 180 targets off the couch and I eclipse 1,000. Stop looking at the stats and check the tape. As far as getting open goes, I'm confident I did that with the best of them. And then CeeDee Lamb ultimately has to respond, which he didn't have to respond, but he did. I don't need 180 targets to touch a band. Pull up tape. I'd match you route for route on getting open. Just chill. There's always some drama, manufactured, real, authentic, inauthentic, between Cowboys players and former Cowboys and Cowboys family members. They just like the drama. They're like TNT, and it's good for them. It keeps them top of mind, keeps us home with the Cowboys, which is why they are the number one TV star on America's number one TV show. So I get it. That's part of it, but it's always some drama with the Cowboys. And I'm sure it happens at other teams. It just does. Number one doesn't play out publicly as it does with the Cowboys, who kind of embrace that culture. And I don't think it's as common. It happens. But the Cowboys, like I said, it happens like weekly. Every other week, there's a story like this about the Cowboys.
And that's, I remember Dalton Schultz came out and said one of the differences between Houston and Dallas was, the weight room. And he said in Dallas, it had a big glass window, and the tourists walk by and they tap on the glass. And he was like, it's just different.
Yes.
Not worse, it's just different. And that was the Dalton Schultz way of saying that. But that's the kind of thing is a lot of teams, I think, when this happens, it's, first of all, everything with the Cowboys is going to be magnified. They're going to be on national news all the time.
Of course.
But you have to then add in that Jerry and the Cowboys don't necessarily call a meeting right away and call an agent and say, that needs to come down. You guys need to squash that. Don't be doing that. We need to be about winning. They don't do that. And if it doesn't come from the top and they're not going to Mike McCarthy and saying, hey, why are you letting your team be out of control? I think the question would be with Jerry, if those things broke out and Mike McCarthy tried to squash it, that Jerry would go, hey, stay out of that business. That's fine. Let the players do what the players do. We're going to go win football games instead. We don't need to worry about that stuff. So it's just a different thought of the culture, and it's something that you can look at and say it probably doesn't help them win, but I can't say that it hurts them at all either, because it's not really infighting. That we'll see more squabbles on other teams that are fights in camp and probably things of that nature than we'll see about the Cowboys of that they get into a lot more squabbles online. They have these stories of ex-Cowboys, once they get out of it, then they seem to have some sort of reservation or something that they want to go back and make a point after the fact that they're gone. That happens a lot more with the Cowboys, but it doesn't seem to be player on player in games and that are both playing on the team at the same time. That's not as much as some other teams. You do see that, of guys not liking each other on their own team and blaming each other for losses. I don't think that's quite as much. You do see it with family members, though, sometimes.
You do. No, you're right. You see it with family members. No, you do, because you brought up the Odell Beckham Jr. thing. That you do see it with family members. Hell, Colt McCoy's wife, remember she called into a radio show unsolicited to talk about, what was going on with basically amateurism at the college level. I think that was one thing she brought up. But so family members, they have opinions, and they make them publicly known. And, yes, so the Cowboys aren't – they aren't unique in that aspect, but I will say it happens more often with the Cowboys. And like you said, everything is magnified because it's the damn Cowboys too. So anyway, there you go. Enough Cowboys. Oh, by the way, also – something I've been thinking about for the Cowboys, though. I've been thinking more and more about this Cowboys running game. I think the Cowboys running game is just going to be poor. It's going to be below average. So more and more fantasy folks out there, I don't even know if you had your fantasy drafts are going to happen and when they're going to happen. Jake Ferguson is somebody to keep in mind in the fantasy realm. Just throwing it out there. I mean, this is a guy that had career highs in receptions and receiving yards last year, 5 touchdowns. Dak loves him. Finished the season with that 10 reception, 93-yard performance. That was the highest single-game fantasy football performance among tight ends all last year by any tight end in the league, 37 points per reception point. You go look at it compared to 22 to 23, he was one of 7 tight ends with 100 targets comparing those 2 years. Weaker running game means he's probably going to get more targets, less target competition in year 2 for him too, because you got some of the receivers that are gone. They're still trying to figure out who's going to be the number 3 receiver. It's going to be Jake Ferguson. The Cowboys are going to throw it more. They were already 6th in pass rate. So doing more research on the Cowboys, I'm high on Jake Ferguson. I'm big on him. I think he's going to have a big year for the Cowboys. So throwing it out there, since we're talking Cowboys, wanted to throw it out there as well. All right, let's hit our Rangers report, and then we'll hit the rant on the other side. And I got two different topics we'll hit in Raj round today, and we'll do that when we come back. But first, let's do the Rangers report.
The Rangers report is brought to you by Texas Truck and Trailer.
All right, Rangers. Hey, man, they're winning back to some of their winning ways. The Rangers beat the Rays 13-2 on Sunday at the Gilf. Finishing off their second sweep of the season, just their third winning homestand all season long. Hopefully it is foreshadowing better things to come for the Rangers. The Rangers have been hovering around 500 all season long. The Rangers recorded a season-high 19 hits. That's a reason to be optimistic. They recorded a season-high 19 hits. They scored 13 runs. That's the most since May 17th at Oakland when they scored 15 runs. It was the most runs Texas has scored at home since September 20th, 2023, against the Red Sox when they scored 15 runs. The 11-run win also marked the Rangers' largest margin of victory of the season and the most decisive win since a 12-0 win in Anaheim on August 14th, 2023. So it seemed like it could be one of those wins or series wins for the Rangers that really – series sweeps, I should say, for the Rangers that gives them a lot of momentum. That is the hope because they look so good doing it. And maybe it could just been, you know, the Rays, but and maybe the Rays were just off that day. But Rangers look like they're old, so they look like a world. They look like a defending world champion, and they haven't really looked like a defending world champion all season, really. Mostly because of injuries, they just hadn't looked that good all season.
No, and I mean, I think so you're going into that second
Rangers
half.
Also. Sorry, good.
Well, that second half of the season where. As we get further into it, this is where the Rangers, you expect to make the run. And you kind of expected it a little bit earlier than what they're doing. But if this is where they hit it, we're almost at that second half. We are two series away. The All-Star game is next week. So this is where you really want to start ramping up the intensity. Corey Seager's back from that little injury. So he's back again. So that when he got hit in the wrist, he's playing baseball again. Had four, you know, played really well the other day. So as long as those guys start playing a little bit better and this starts going the way, then you'll get that big AL West competition down the stretch that everybody's been looking forward to.
Yeah, good stuff. And speaking of the All-Star game, you have two Rangers who ended up being selected as All-Stars. Second baseman Marcus Semien has been selected to the American League roster via player voting. He has been an All-Star selection in two straight and three of the last four seasons. One of those with Toronto. Semien is one of just five Texas second basemen ever selected for an All-Star game, joining Dave Nelson, Julio Franco, Alfonso Soriano, Ian Kinsler on that list. He also joins Franco, Kinsler, and Soriano as Rangers with multiple selections at second base. And Kirby Yates also selected to the All-Star team. Kirby Yates selected to the American League roster via player voting. Yates is the first Texas relief pitcher since Joe Nathan in 2013 and the fifth different Rangers pitcher to make the team in the past five All-Star contests. That's Mike Minor, joining Mike Minor, Kyle Gibson, Martin Perez, and Nathan Eovaldi. According to Stathead, Yates is only the fifth pitcher in club history to be named an All-Star in his age 37 or older season, joining Nathan and Kenny Rogers and Nolan Ryan and Charlie Huff in 1986. So right now, Kirby Yates, arguably, he's been one of the best relievers in Major League Baseball, period. His ERA, 0.86, second in Major League Baseball, opposing batting average, first at 126 in Major League Baseball, opposing slugging percentage, he's first in Major League Baseball, 175, opposing OPS, second in Major League Baseball right now, so he is... I mean, he's one of the best pitchers right now in baseball, so deserving for Kirby Yates. All right, so there you go. Two Rangers getting some All-Star love. That is our Rangers report.
The Rangers report is brought to you by Texas Truck and Trailer, your premier truck accessory dealer.
All right, we're coming to time to get to Raj Rant. We'll go behind, get to the break here, and then we'll get into Raj Rant of the day on the other side. We'll talk football. Why is scoring first so important in football? And also, we'll talk about the most fertile recruiting, most fertile regions of talent, I should say, football-wise, in the country. All of that and more right here on the broadcast featuring Patrick Davis. I'm Lifetime Longhorn. Rod Babers coming back on the horn.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore!
Find out what happens when people stop being polite
and start getting real.
You ain't keeping it real!
My God! Okay, it's happening! Everybody stay calm!
No, oh, you've done it now. It's time for Rod's Rant of the Day.
Hold on to your butts.
All right, welcome back to the Rodcast. Time to get into Rod's Rant of the Day. I got a couple of topics that I want to hit. Well, we got some time here. So the first one is a stat, actually a group of stats that I saw from Warren Sharp. Does a good job, data scientist. Gives you stats about the NFL, when you're talking about Sharp Football or his own personal account. And he did the research in the last 10 years on the winning percentage of teams who score first. Touchdown first, field goal first, however you score. Score safety first, whatever. You put points on the board first, and he basically correlate that to win percentage. And he found that teams who score first in the NFL over the last 10 years win 64% of the time. It's a pretty high success rate. So you just score first, you win 64% of the time. He looked at the teams who've won the most games when scoring first over the last 2 years. Baltimore, Philadelphia is 23, Cleveland's 22, along with San Fran and Detroit. The Cowboys are at 21. The Chiefs are at 19, along with Jacksonville. So, you know, he laid out all the teams and which ones were most successful. Speaking of Kansas City, how about this with Kansas City? The Kansas City Chiefs 18-1 when scoring first the last 2 years, and 7-8 though when they allow the opponent to score first. So 18-1, they score first. Good chance Kansas City is going to win, and they do score first a lot of times because they got Patrick Mahomes, best quarterback in the game, best play caller in Andy Reid in the game, and so they end up scoring first. Because he's also a brilliant play designer and play caller and usually designs a really good script. Cowboys, also 10-0 when scoring first. Last year, they went 2-5. Last year, they went 2-5 when allowing their opponent to score first. Yeah. So they are pretty much the epitome of this stat. I mean, they embody that stat. You score first, you win most of the time. There are some teams who are outliers to this. The Chargers, they scored first in 11 of 17 games last year, but went 5-6 in those games. 0-6 though when allowing opponents to score first. So it halfway holds for them. They lost a lot of games when they allowed opponents to score first, but when they scored first, didn't necessarily work out for them. The Bears are like that too. Over the last 2 years, Chicago has scored first in 18 of 34 games, but just 8-10 in those games. So on just 44% of those games. And we're 2-14 in all other games. So Bears are just bad. But the Bears scored first in 10 games last year, but went 6-4 in those 10 games. But 1-6 when allowing a point to score first. So it still tracks, but just doesn't. They don't benefit from it. Some of these teams don't benefit from it as much, but they're definitely on the downside. They are definitely on the downside of it when they allow their opponents to score first. So 64% of the time you score first, you win football games in the NFL. I mean, the reason for that is I think ultimately it's confidence. I think it's just ultimately deflating when you're riding the wave of positive vibes and confident thoughts. All right, and the team is confident, maybe even overconfident. It can be extremely deflating. And I think some teams are more resilient than others. Quarterbacks more resilient than others. Some coaches are more resilient than others. And they could be more effective. And I think psychologically, it's not as deflating, depressing for them when they are playing at a, with a deficit or playing from a deficit. And some teams, they're made to be front runners and play with a lead. And they don't do well when they have to play from – and at the 49ers actually kind of like that. The 49ers don't play well from a deficit. I mean, go look at the, over the years with Shano, his teams, and go look at how often they win games when they have to come from behind. It doesn't happen very often. They've done it. I'm not saying they don't do it. But they're usually built to be a front runner because once they get a lead on you, then they just pound the rock, run the football, and they drain the clock, limit your possessions, and then that's when they're up, you get desperate, you decide, I have to throw to get back into the game. Their defensive line is very formidable, and that's when the complimentary football takes effect. And everybody's kind of got their own version of that. So scoring first, I think I always compared it to it's a confidence thing. I mean, you score first, you got a lot of confidence, you got a lot of swagger, you feel good about yourself. And it's amazing if you start something really well, how often it'll help you have more confidence, even if you have a pitfall or even if you stumbled along the way. The good start it'll give you psychologically the motivation you need to overcome. It's like, no, I know I can do it. I had a good start. I'm okay. But a bad start can often send you down a spiral, as opposed to a good start. So I think mostly it's psychological. My comparison was, if you ever been broke before, and most people were broke, you've probably gone out when you're broke, and you're going out right after payday. Going out with money in your pocket, you act different. You probably talk a little bit differently. You're more likely to be the life of the party. You're probably a lot more generous. Your game's a lot better. When you're hitting on the ladies or even in response to somebody hitting on you, you're more confident in your delivery. Your whole entire – I bet you your shoulders and your posture is probably better overall when you have money in your pocket as opposed to when you don't because you're a little bit more insecure about yourself. You're not willing to be the life of the party because, hey, man, you might not be able to pay for it. Being the life of the party. You're probably not hitting on as many chicks when you go out just because you don't have the confidence you once did. It's the difference. There may be subtle differences, but you're a different person with the cash in your pocket as opposed to somebody who's going out without that money. And I think you play like that. When you play with a lead, you got money in your pocket. When you're playing in a deficit, it's kind of like playing without that money in your pocket. You're not as confident. You think you are, but you're not. It's maybe subconscious more than anything. All right, so another football-related topic that I wanted to get to here. And this one, I couldn't really figure out the kind of underlying theory as to what, after identifying this trend, what caused this trend. So I was looking at this new study. Football Scoop is where I saw it published, and they do a good job. So they're looking at states that produce the most NFL players per million people. Usually they do this thing per capita, but they did it per million people in that state. And I thought it was pretty interesting some of the results they found. So essentially the premise is they looked at an average. So the average number of NFL players produced per NFL state per million people. And then they looked at every state compared to that average and see if you were underrepresented in terms of compared to the average, or your state disproportionately produced more NFL players than the average per million, and see which states were overrepresented there and which states, you know, disproportionately produced fewer NFL players than the average per million people. So I found there were 21 states basically that produced more NFL players than the average. And I was a little surprised when I looked at the 21 states and some of these states, just where they were located, and others, just really how these different regions were divided up. So here's the fun part. So there are 21 states that actually were higher than the average. The highest is Louisiana. Louisiana, and I've been saying this for years, for the last 7, 8 years, probably going on 10 now, Louisiana's always top three NFL players produced per capita, period. It's just it is something about Louisiana. Louisiana is easily one of the most fertile recruiting grounds, fertile pockets of talent in the country when it comes to football. And based on this study, it's number one. 15 players per million people. Mississippi is second, 14.5. Alabama third. Georgia is fourth. There was a trend here. But this is where the trend breaks up. So that's all SEC country. That doesn't surprise anybody. The southeastern region of the United States is easily the most fertile football development ground in the country for the last 15, 20, 30 years, probably even going back further than that. So that explains the top four. Then fifth on here is Iowa. Yeah. Iowa jumps into, if you're looking at it. So Iowa, as recently, you say based on this study, because they're doing it, remember, the per million people, and they got Iowa right there in the top five per million people. That was the one that was a little surprising to me. And then you'll notice, if you keep going down, then they have, I think, D.C. Remember I told you guys about D.C. being one of the most fertile metro areas for producing NFL talent? Remember last year I went over, or at least last draft, I went over how they made it into my top 10, the D.C. area, just because they, in a lot, since 2020, I've been keeping up with it since 2020, the D.C. area now has jumped into my top 10 for producing most NFL players. And I think it's a big part of it is because, man, D.C., that Maryland area, is highly underrated when it comes to NFL talent or producing NFL talent. So D.C.'s in there, Florida, and then Hawaii is also in there. And that's because of the Polynesian culture. And we talked about this too. You have a lot of, you're talking about the hit rates of that certain culture. And I think that's where you're looking at the Hawaiian influence there. But there are four out of those 21 states, essentially there are four areas, four regions of the country that are all considered, I think, your hotbeds for developing NFL talent. Of course, there's southeast, there's southeastern, you know, United States. That's your SEC country. There are nine states, essentially, that are all bordering each other. And that includes Texas now, too. If you want to include Texas as your own separate region, just because Texas is so damn big, you could do that. If you really wanted to, you could do that. But if you wanted to look at Texas as part of the SEC, which technically it is now, it would be nine states, all of them bordering. Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, all bordering each other. And they are all above the average, overly represented, if you will, in producing NFL talent. That's your SEC country in a nutshell. That's it. It's nine states and nothing, no other region in the country even comes close to producing, have that many states producing that much NFL talent. But then, in addition to the SEC, then you got a Midwest pocket, which is Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, all producing NFL talent above the average per million people, 5.4, 6.2, 5.9, and then include Iowa in there. No, I take it back. That's Midwest. That's Heartland. So Midwest is just Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. Then you got a Heartland, which is included with Iowa. That's Iowa. That's Utah, Wyoming, and Nebraska. Iowa is at 12.5. They're an outlier all by themselves. You know, that's just that is among the top five best per million numbers in this study. In there was one of those SEC states. But then there's Utah, Wyoming, and Nebraska, 5.5, 5.2, 6.1. And then there's Iowa, as I pointed out, 12.5. That's another pocket. And they're all bordering states as well. Utah, Wyoming, Nebraska, Iowa, all border each other. And then you go look at, like I just told you, the Midwest, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, all bordering each other. So there's a Midwest pocket, there's a Heartland pocket, and there's an SEC pocket, and all of those pockets have states that all border each other. And then on the East Coast, there is D.C., Maryland, Delaware, and Jersey, 5.5, 6.1, 6.8, and 8.7, D.C.'s 8.7, and those states territories all border each other as well. So it's crazy. I don't know how it worked out that way. And then there's Hawaii, separate. Okay, all right, Hawaii doesn't have anything to border it. All right, but it's, like I said, all of these areas, Midwest, East Coast, Heartland, and the Southeastern Conference, essentially, South SEC territory, they all have the states that border each other. They all are connecting states, pretty much. That, I believe, there's definitely something that, there's a reason for this, some sociological reason that I'm missing, that all those pockets are all in bordering states. Like, none of this is divided up, really. And every other state, like I said, these are 21 of the states that are producing NFL players above the average. Every other state pretty much is below the average producing NFL. There's only one state that has zero players currently on NFL rosters, and that's Vermont, as we pointed that out. But, yeah, I went and looked at that D.C. area, Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore, I went, you guys remember I did this study a while ago. I went and looked at metro areas that produced the most NFL talent. I didn't do per capita. I didn't do per million people. I just looked up drafted players since 2020, and I looked at metro areas. Baltimore in my top five now. So that's kind of that East Coast area. And New York is in my top 10. New York was in my top 10. So based on my research on metro areas, New York and Baltimore both end up in the top 10 for that East Coast, those East Coast pockets. So I guess you could kind of do it by metro areas the way I did it too. But I think you would have more separation. You wouldn't have as many, you know, basically has as many obviously links to each other as you do when you do it better per million people. But yeah, it's interesting that Iowa and the Heartland jumps out more than I would have expected. Utah, Wyoming, New England, and Iowa. Everything else is predictable. The predictable pocket in the Midwest, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, I think everybody would predict that. Maybe Indiana surprised you a little bit. The SEC states, that makes sense. And like I said, the East Coast pockets, I could have predicted that just from my research about metro areas producing the most NFL talent, because I was surprised when I saw Baltimore and New York rising to my top 10. So I could have guessed that, and now that New York is probably a Jersey crossover there too. They call it the tri-state area there. So that would have made sense. The one that really surprised me here that I did not see coming was that Heartland pocket of talent there. Utah, Wyoming, Nebraska, and Iowa. Who saw that coming? Yeah, Iowa. Jumping up there, producing a lot. And I wonder how many of those are linemen as opposed to skill talent from Iowa. That's the next study I'm going to try to find, and maybe I can rabbit hole it if I have time, in terms of the positions from these different regions and pockets around the country. Are they producing a certain position disproportionately at a higher rate than other areas of the country? And it's definitely the case because Texas and quarterbacks. I mean, that just jumps to mind. You know, Texas is producing more quarterbacks than every other state. And I'd like to know if, hell, Iowa's producing. Iowa and Nebraska, are they producing more linemen than everybody else? Is that, you know what I mean? Did they always say the corn-fed guys? Are they coming from Iowa and Nebraska? It'd be very interesting to see if that is indeed the case. All right, we come back. We'll have a segment of Who Said That. That's when my man Patrick plays bits of audio from the sports world and from beyond. And based on the context clues and based on the familiarity of the voice, hopefully you can recall and identify who said that. We'll have that when we come back right here on the broadcast featuring Patrick Davis on Lifetime Longhorn. Rod Babers coming back on the horn.
Happy you near me, happy you here.
All right, welcome back to the Rodcast. It is a Smooth So Monday edition of the Rodcast. Thanks to my man Patrick Davis and his efforts trying to make your transition from the stress-free, fun-filled holiday weekend to the stress-filled, hectic work week. He tries to make sure that it's a smooth transition for you because you get a little bit bumpy with the meetings and the traffic and oh man, you probably got extra meetings. You missed time last week, and it's going to be a very stressful week for, I think, for a lot of folks out there. So my man Patrick wants to hook you up with a Smooth Soul Monday to make sure it is as smooth as possible of a transition for you. So we appreciate him. Also, go check out the topic for the Big Fat Poll today. That is up as well on X. You can go check it out. Which big free agent signing will make it further in the playoffs next year? And right now, Klay Thompson. Clearly in the lead, 60% of the respondents to the poll believe Klay Thompson will be the free agent signing that takes his team further than the rest of the free agent signings so far that we've seen in the NBA. So there you go, NBA discussion today. So thanks to my man Patrick for that. Now it's time to get into Who Said That. That's when Patrick plays some pieces of audio based on the context clues or familiarity of the voice. Hopefully you can recall and identify who said that.
I'd be surprised that you actually won a game, but what I would have changed was, okay, this part of me that I actually still love, like when I see these young players, I see like Patrick, you know, out there at quarterback running around, laughing, having fun. I'm like, I used to be like that. What the hell happened to me? You know, right. And I just got too serious. And you know, but again, I can only look back and think, okay, if I do it again, which I'll never do it again, I would be different. But the reality is you can't. So you just learn from it and go, okay, now next phase of life, enjoy it a little more.
Ooh, Tom Brady saying he got too serious toward the end of his career. Should have been a little bit more fun-loving toward the end of his career. I disagree with Tom on that one. I know he would know better than me. I mean, it's Tom's life, not mine. But I don't know if you win all the championship if you're loving fun that much.
I don't know. Happy Luca.
MJ didn't embrace that much fun.
No, but Happy Luca, man. Look at Happy
Luca. Champion. Didn't have any championships.
No, but that was because Mad Luca came back.
What a championship's Happy Luca?
No, but Mad Luca came back in that
series. I know, but I said for Tom Brady, Tom Brady's better with a chip on his shoulder, there's no doubt.
Oh,
Tom Brady's better with a chip on his shoulder. He's better when he's angry. He's better when he's got something to prove. He's better when he's upset. That's not fun-loving. Fun-loving, Tom, is, hey, I got a lot of money, and I'm married to a supermodel, and my kids are beautiful and great.
He's not married to a supermodel
I'm
anymore.
I'm basically considered the GOAT. Exactly. And that's honestly, that's when he won another title again. It's basically when his marriage started crumbling, and he's basically, I got something to prove. My wife doesn't think I'm going to be a champion. I think he was kind of out to prove, like, no, wifey, I am sacrificing my family, but it is to win a title, and I will win a championship. You know what I mean? Like, I think Tom Brady's better with the chip on his shoulder, with the angst. And I think if he was fun loving, he would have prioritized other things, which, by the way, it's perfectly healthy and rational to prioritize other things other than winning. But that obsession is what we admire about him and MJ, that competitive sickness. They didn't have fun doing it because they were obsessed with greatness and excellence. And you can have fun doing it, but it's tougher. It's tougher to be that fun-loving. It requires a certain focus that I don't know if it's going to be a fun-filled focus.
Yeah, I think you can have fun sometimes.
It's crystallized.
There's
deadly focus.
Yeah, there's times where you got to take it super serious, and then there's times where you can have a little bit more fun. When you're up by 35 points in a game, you can have a little. You can smile and laugh and not go yell at your teammates on the bench. At that point, you can say, okay, let's have some fun. It's week four of the season. We're playing really well. We're winning by a bunch. Let's have fun. You can do that, and that may be sometimes where he was too serious and going back on the bench and, how do you get a false start? Man, if we're fine. We still scored a touchdown on the drive. How do you get a false start, though?
I know. Still, that having everybody else with that kind of focus, too, every day, that's how you build dynasties.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. The fun-loving, fun-filled stuff is good, but having everybody focus, that's the F word that I want. The fun one. Focus. Focus. All right, good stuff there, Patrick, all day long. Good stuff. We appreciate you. Thank you guys out there for listening. We appreciate you as well. Remember, the revolution will not be televised. We'll talk about it right here on the Rodcast. We appreciate you guys. We love you. We also mean that for real. Join us tomorrow, same time, same channel. Until next time, hook 'em and peace.